Do it twice.
He claps Marcus on the shoulder. Guess I better do it right, buddy. He glances up at Juno's monitor to see that it's blank. Looks like the system timed you out. You want to see something interesting? Dorian drags Marcus and props his curled body against one of the cabinets, so the synthetic has a good view of what's happening. Dorian then flexes his long fingers and types Javier's username and password into the console. First, let's seal the doors, he says, and asks Juno to go into full lockdown. His heart skips a beat as the entrance to the server cage hisses closed, but it's fine. No creatures inside with him. Even if there were monsters lurking outside, they probably couldn't get through the thick glass. Marcus's eyes remain fixed on the screen. Dorian imagines Blue in her room, frantically trying to regain control of her surrogate. While it's a delicious image, she might actually succeed, and then he would die. How to stop her from further interference? That's the real question. Dorian spots a cabinet with a fire extinguisher inside, so he opens it and takes the red cylinder into his hands. It has a lovely weight to it, an undeniable density. Then he strides over to Marcus and gently thunks the android on the scalp, eliciting a bass tone from the steel. He swings the pressurized bottle in front of Marcus's eyes, shaking it like he's dangling a treat. I like it this way, Dorian says, hitting Marcus's forehead with the rim of the extinguisher, a little harder this time. Destroying someone with a device meant to save lives. There's some poetry in that. What do you think, Blue? Using it like a battering ram, he smashes the cylinder into the side of Marcus's head, pinning the android's brain case against the edge of a server rack. Marcus makes no response, but Dorian can almost feel Blue shrieking for him to stop. Maybe she'll choke on her own spit. Tough to answer with no motor functions, eh? Dorian strikes again, putting his back into it, using the corner of the rack like a splitting wedge. Spasmodically, the android's eyes flick left and right, but he sees no visible damage. That won't work. He won't be happy until he's washed his hands in Marcus's milky blood. What do you think, Blue? Dorian presses a foot into Marcus's shoulder, pushing the android's skull up against the edge of the rack. Taking the fire extinguisher by the neck, Dorian swings it like a baseball bat, and is rewarded with a loud crack and a clang for his efforts. A small ridge emerges across Marcus's forehead, evidence of a fractured brain case. There we go. He strikes the fake plastic head again, and Marcus slumps face up onto the ground. There we fucking go. He raises the extinguisher over his head and with a final shout smashes Marcus's skull open with a spray of white blood. Dorian drops the bottle and stumbles back, breath rushing in and out. His face prickles with heat and he touches his clammy neck, sighing away the heavy breathing. He presses his fingers into his neck and checks his pulse, just as he's done 1,000 times before while jogging. His heart rate slows as his body reaches rest. He looks down at his hands, covered in milk. He'd felt Blue's terror, her anger, and her understanding that she'd lost, inexorably, to the greater man. She won't be getting off the cold forge. The others won't be able to help her. Dorian has begun to devour her, and killing Marcus was the first lethal bite. He should have done this to his father, instead of paying for the man's nursing home bills. That would have been some justice. Dorian touches his cheek, and his fingers come away with his own blood. His wound needs stitches, but that's only so he can bring his skin back to an earthly standard of beauty. The cut is the doorway to something underneath, something greater. He imagines pulling back the skin to find black chitin. Dipping his fingers into the pooling synthetic blood in Marcus's wound, he lifts them to his lips. It has a taste like aspartame, with a breathy undertone of truffle oil. He shouldn't be wasting this precious time. He rises and returns to the terminal, tries to remember how Anne said they were going to rescue Blue. Something about the maintenance tubes. It had been so hard to pay attention to what she actually said in that moment before he killed her. What was the correct phrasing? Equalize pressure for maintenance tubes and unseal. Docking bay structural integrity compromised. Potential for decompression in the event of further damage. Continue? Yes or no? Dorian rolls his eyes. Yes. Unlike human beings, the computer doesn't protest. Equalizing maintenance tube pressure, 100%. Confirmed, 1 atmosphere pressure, maint tubes. Warning, extreme danger. Crew use should follow EVA protocols. That's enough to bridge the gap, but not enough to attract the snatchers. They're naturally precocious. They'll get out there eventually, but it could take hours. He racks his brain to think of what else he can do in the meantime to smoke Blue out. He wants to open the heat shields on that side of the station, but he's not sure how they work. And Blue needs to be eaten. Shut down all airflow in crew quarters. Disable heat dispersers. Within minutes, that module will be more than 25 degrees Celsius. The air will grow close and muggy. The bitch can die miserable. He tries to think back to his arrival in this magical place. There were those lights, the ones that showed him the way. What had Cardozo called them? Navigation system status. Commissioned and online. Would you like directions? He licks his lips and considers the best way to phrase the request. He's never been much for information technologies, but these servers are supposed to be intuitive. Besides, he's a fast learner. Kennels to crew quarters, room 08. This path includes maint tubes. No navigation available in maint tubes. Extreme danger. Continue? Yes or no? Yes. Maximum brightness, please. Acknowledged. He strides to a clear section of window and looks down. A thin green line of light appears across the floor, pulsing toward the central strut. He watches with delight as one of the creatures appears, skittering across the open bay to investigate. But he doesn't want all of them going to the crew quarters. He still has a use for them inside the skiff. He needs to track them. Blue had a trick for that. Video analytics. Subject of analysis. Non-human life forms. Advisory. Cannot identify microscopic organisms with current video loadout. Dorian snorts in annoyance. Plot large non-human life forms. Provide access control. Plotting. 100%. The terminal changes to a station schematic, with several dozen red dots roving around. They've begun to converge on the green line running to the maintenance tubes. They're curious beasts, quick to react to any changes in their environment, a lot like people, except they aren't useless. Dorian looks at the name of the nearest screen, printed on a peeling sticker at the bottom. Give me video feeds on screen, Juno-2A. Activating. The monitor flickers to life, filling with tiles upon tiles of labeled security camera feeds. Dorian doesn't recognize all the locations, but he can follow the map from the terminal monitor. Selecting a door in a secluded corner of the skiff, he toggles it open and closed. Some of the red dots rush over to inspect it. Dorian tries another door somewhere else, opening it up. The beasts follow his cues without a moment's pause. If only they could sense his hand guiding them. They would follow so much faster. He'll bring them treats. Watching the security feeds, he spies Rose Eagle Laboratory Alpha. Peering at the screen, he watches the people inside, scurrying about what remains of their little lives, working in some vain hope of rescue. Even if they could get a message to Earth, nothing would have spared them. Starvation and slow roasting would have been their fates. Dorian has never experienced a joy like this in his life. Giddy. He thinks of the ancient prince of Denmark, accused of madness. I must be cruel, only to be kind. Thus bad begins, and worse remains behind. 25. Never. Never. Blue jerks the helmet off her head, her throat stoppered by a laryngeal spasm. The more she fights it, the less she can breathe. Salty tears stream from her eyes, and her teeth chatter with rage. How had she been so stupid? Anne is dead. Anne, who never loved her. Anne, the last to touch her. She has to force herself to calm down, or she'll aspirate when her throat comes untangled. Blue holds the breath she doesn't have, eyes bulging, head growing light. She feels a trickle of cool air in her throat, and it takes everything to fight her instinct to gasp. If she gasps, she'll close it up again. Taking the tiniest breaths, she tries to relax. Can't pass out. She might need intubation again, and there's no one to help her. That son of a bitch can't kill her like this. But in a way, he has killed her. Without Marcus, there is no sample. Without the sample, there's no rescue waiting for her. No one will come and get her from her room or drag her to an escape pod. More tears roll down her cheeks. It's all over. Now all she has to do is lie back and wait to die. She wraps her arms around herself and reclines in her bed, too lightheaded to stop the coming sleep, too weak to give a fuck. She tried her best, and that wasn't good enough. And now she's going to fall into a star. The useless helmet rests upon her hips, its wiring harness running down to the wall terminal like a tail. She wants to take it and throw it across the room, but she doesn't have the strength. She's about to push it off the bed when she remembers that Marcus isn't the only thing to which it can connect. There's the Caterpillar P-5000 power loader. Her heart thumps with explosive rage. With that exoskeleton, she can tear apart anything that comes between her and Dorian. The loader has all of Marcus's access, so it can move about the station freely. She wonders if he uploaded any of his persona into it. Will it be angry when she uses it to snap Dorian like a twig? Faced with his own death, will he be glad? Who gives a fuck? She's about to put on her helmet when the door to her room opens. The sudden noise jolts her so hard she almost vomits. The corridor outside is dim. It must be the night cycle. Reflected in the shadows is a weak green light, pulsing slowly like a buoy floating on the waves. She leans forward, trying to make out its source, but can't quite figure it out. Then, the white noise disappears from her room, ventilation fans spinning down into silence. Blue works her jaw, the sudden lack of sound giving her the distinct impression of having clogged ears. Perhaps it's a glitch in the failing computer system. Blue considers ignoring the new development and putting on the helmet, but it nags at her. She needs to investigate, but that'll involve some crawling, and she's not sure she's up to it. Peering over the edge of the bed, she tries to ascertain whether her knocking knees will carry her safely to the floor. The green beckons to her. Blue slides the helmet to safety, then convinces her legs to leave the bed. The rest of her comes tumbling behind like a sack of potatoes. Her forehead slams into the metal floor and she cries out in pain. She pushes herself up onto her arms, the only muscles with any strength left, and inspects the spot where she hit. The impact will leave a knot, but she's been through a hell of a lot worse in the past few hours. Pulling herself across the floor, inch by inch, she reaches her door. Wrapping her fingers around the lip, she pulls herself even with the hallway to the rest of the crew quarters. There's a thin strip of LEDs in the hall with a green light running along them. It's the navigation system, for guiding people around the station. It's been so long for Blue that she barely remembers it. She only had to use it a few times in the very beginning, and even then, it wasn't all that helpful. Who is left, trying to find her room? A creature's scream echoes in the darkness down the long corridor that leads to the central strut. She knows that tone all too well. It's the noise they make when they call out to one another. Her veins fill with ice. They're coming. Blue scrambles back into her room, pulling herself up on a nearby table to slap at the door closure panel. If she can lock it, they might lose interest in her and go back to where there are more humans to eat. Her fingers bounce off the door frame, and she gets it closed on the second slap. She manages to strike the lock button, and with a chime, the door panel turns red. Then it turns green. Then the door opens again. Dorian is controlling it from the server room. He closes it, then opens it, then shuts it once more, as if to say, "Yeah, I'm here to watch you die." She knows he'll toggle it again as a signal once they get closer. Blue crawls as fast as she can, frantically scanning the room for some way to hide from them. Her bed is too tall, with no cover underneath. They'd find her in seconds. She spies a ventilation duct, but knows they'll sniff her out. Without Marcus to sponge her, she's grown pungent. No, she must ward them off entirely. Maybe she could improvise a flamethrower using Dorian's matches. Her room has tubes and oxygen feeds, but the plastic would melt. She crawls to the bed to fetch the matches and striker from between the mattress and frame, fishing her fingers into the crevice. She hadn't ever intended to retrieve them, and only finds three sticks, as many as she'd left him. Maybe she should just jam her pen into the ball spring valve of one of the oxygen tanks and fill the air with flammable gas. She could spark a match and take out a few of those fuckers with her. But then she imagines Dorian watching from Juno's control center, a wide grin on his face. Fuck that. So she can make an explosion, but she has to find a way to survive it. If she had time, she'd rig some kind of remote spark using a circuit board, wiring, and a few calls over the network. But that's ridiculous. Even if she hides inside the ventilation duct, it'll send shreds of the vent cover into her face, along with the flames. She needs something solid and flat to place between her and the explosion. Something that'll cover the vent completely. In the corner of the room sits Marcus's nursing stand, where he keeps the clean implements he needs for minor urgent care. Scissors, gauze, and an assortment of other clean packaged items. They all rest atop a detachable metal tray a little larger than the vent shaft cover. Blue surveys her course through the room. She's going to have to climb upright twice to make this happen. Once at the desk for her pen, and once at the bed for the oxygen valve. Using the drawer handles as a ladder, she pulls herself toward the work surface, kicking her atrophied legs to try and get her knees under her body. She brings her eyes level with the desktop and spots one of Marcus's pens, arranged to be exactly parallel to the wall. She throws her arm across it and smacks her palm down on the pen before dragging it onto the floor with her. She's panting, so exhausted after what she's done, but she can't stop to rest. Struggling to the bed, she takes hold of the side rail, then scoots her butt to better position herself. Her hand muscles and biceps burn, but she pulls herself up high enough to get a second hand on the side rail. A few weeks ago, she wouldn't have thought she could do this once, and now she's done it a few times in 2 days. She folds at the waist over the side of the bed, her legs dangling helplessly over the edge, yanks the medical tubes out of the oxygen valves, and tosses them to the floor. She then unscrews the barrel of the ballpoint pen and pulls out the cartridge, leaving a hollow body with a funneled point. The cap fits almost perfectly within the entrance of the ball spring valve, and Blue shoves until the pen won't go any deeper. A sharp, whistling hiss fills the air. Too sharp, perhaps. The valves weren't meant to be opened this wide. There's a flammability alarm when there's too much oxygen in the room. It shuts off her tanks when the alarm is triggered. That means, once the alarm sounds, she only has a short while before her oxygen dissipates harmlessly. Her gaze falls upon her portable terminal, resting upon her nightstand. She needs to bring it with her if she can. It's the last, best way to access Juno and Titus, and maybe the power loader. She hugs it against her chest and falls back to the floor, protecting it with her body. She strikes her shoulder and almost cries out, but stifles it. Every part of her is exhausted, and she feels like she's on the edge of a seizure, like distant rumbles before a storm. The nursing tray isn't far from her, maybe a yard or so. She must crawl over the caster base of the gurney to get to it. Her hands and arms don't want to cooperate anymore. She's put them through too much already, and she needs to rest. No time. She hauls herself over the bed's base to the nursing tray. She'd originally thought she would pull herself up on it, but her body won't let her. She rocks the nursing stand to see if the tray is detached, and it sways freely. She could knock it over, but that would be like smashing a gong while the snatchers stalk the hallways. She'll have to catch the tray if she wants to live long enough to get into the ventilation duct. Grasping the stand, she leans it carefully toward her. It's lighter than she expected, and it topples almost immediately. Blue catches the tray, but the tools on it roll and clink to the ground. She flinches hard, certain that the chitinous beasts will come scrabbling at her doorway like hungry cats. But they don't. And Blue is left staring at the closed portal, shaking. She rolls onto her stomach and crawls toward the maintenance shaft, pushing the tray and portable terminal with her chin. They make a negligible scraping sound, but it sounds like a bullhorn. Reaching her goal, she pushes the tray and computer aside so she can get better access to the ventilation cover and its knurled thumb screws. She takes hold of the first one, and it refuses to turn. In her heyday, Blue could open any jar or bottle, but now her pinch grip strength isn't enough. Either that, or some maintenance person threaded the screws too tightly. She eyes the slot that goes across the top of the screw head and glances back to the tools on the ground. Next to the roll of gauze, she finds a pair of surgical scissors. Her lock beeps, freezing her heart in solid ice. Dorian is locking and unlocking her door to get their attention. Not dead yet. Just go. With her soft medical slippers, she hooks her big toe through the finger ring of the scissors and drags them upward toward her hand. Grabbing them, she slots one of the blades into the screw head and twists with a little more leverage. The screw clicks free, and she repeats the process on the other screws before shoving the scissors aside. She's gotten the first screw entirely out when a terrifying sound fills her ears. The oxygen saturation alarm. It rings out again, and the hiss of her oxygen leak fades. Another hiss comes in its wake, muffled out in the hallway. Dorian hasn't opened the door yet. He's savoring this. Fuck, 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 fuck. Blue mouths the words as her fingers work the second screw, unwilling to utter even the tiniest noise. She takes out the third screw. The oxygen alarm rings again. How many goddamned warnings do they get? There might have been a footstep outside her door. It doesn't matter. She can't look back. What would it change if she did? The fourth screw comes free, and she pulls the grate aside before carefully setting it on the floor. With all of her strength, she lifts the portable terminal into the ventilation duct. It's grown so unbelievably heavy. The door opens, and the sounds of chewing and ripping meat slide into Blue's ears. One of them is eating Merrimack. The dead bastard bought her some time. She frantically slides inside, but there's no room to turn around, so she has to push back out. Her skin is electric with fear. This isn't her best plan. It's not even a reasonable plan. If she isn't eaten, she'll be blown to pieces. Blue turns around on the floor and positions herself to go in feet first. She pushes herself backward, her robes riding up her thinning body, scraping her stoma-ridden stomach even more. The lock panel on her open door chimes a few more times in rapid succession. A dinner bell. The creature in the hallway screams. Blue tucks her shoulders and pushes all the way into the darkness of the shaft. She pulls in her computer, then reaches out and takes hold of the nurse's pan, ready to position it over the opening. As she lifts it into place, Blue swears she can see a snatcher's long talons wrapping around her doorframe. She wants to scream, but she holds it in. Years of pain have taught her how. The nursing tray must be propped at just the right angle. It's big enough to fully cover the opening. Too much, and it might be knocked free during the explosion. Too little, and it might tip forward and give her away. It's solid surgical steel. If it seals against the opening, it should blunt the explosion. Blue sets it into place and scoots further into the ventilation shaft to put even the tiniest distance between herself and her room. The oxygen alarm has stopped. Does that mean her room is safe? It can't be. It's only been a few seconds. With shaking hands, Blue draws the trio of matches from her pocket and lines one up with the striker, only to immediately break it in half. She hasn't lit a match since she was a small child, and there aren't a lot of uses for them in modern life. Tossing it to the side, she raises the next match, aligning it to the striker. She's deep enough into the ventilation duct that her feet come to rest against the deactivated airflow motor. Blue ignites the match, and as she places it against the tiny crack between wall and tray, her own shaking hand extinguishes it. One match left. Maybe she can wait for them to clear off. They might not see her. Then comes the click of a talon so close to the opening that Blue can count the toes. It's now or never. Light the fire, or lose the oxygen. So she edges up to the tray, so close she can almost touch it with her forehead. She holds the last match close to her body, as though it's the last remaining source of heat in the universe. She places it against the striker. The crack on one side of the tray darkens. Black lips, a sneer, viscous drool and glassy teeth. It hisses like a flamethrower, and Blue gasps, taking in its fetid breath. It's been eating corpses. Then she exhales the words, "Fuck you," as she strikes the match. The flame catches and zips around the corner of the tray. Fire licks between the openings, scorching her arms in the fraction of a second. Then the explosive pressure snaps the tray against the ventilation duct with a deafening clap, and Blue screams. The explosion has nowhere to go except out her door, but she could swear she failed to fit the tray right. A roar fills her head and rattles her bones, spinning her world with the concussive blast. The howl dies to tinny ringing, like a drill on teeth. She imagines the beast propelled into the hallway. The creature's cries drown out hers, its anguish palpable, and she remembers the fury of the one she let burn to death over the fires of Kaufman. She'd been so terrified then. This time, she was close enough to touch it with her flesh and blood hands. She backs away, as station fire alarms blare, curling further and further into the ventilation duct. The fan unit blocks any further egress. Steam forces its way inside the duct with her, scorching her exposed face and hands. The pressure in the room diminishes, and the nursing tray falls away, creaking and steaming. A shadow thrashes in the flames, its scorpion tail striking everything in sight, its mouth and toothy tongue snapping at anything it can find. Her linens have caught fire, belching dark smoke and licking the ceiling in spite of the sprinklers. The creature isn't going to die, though. The systems designed to save the humans on the station are going to extinguish the flames around it, and it will kill her. Then it knocks over her medicine cabinet, full of all her supplies for the next 6 months. Gallons and gallons of isopropyl alcohol, along with emergency oxygen bottles and spare compounding waxes. The resultant fire is like staring into Kaufman's light. Heat washes over Blue's face as the flames begin to draw their air from the ventilation duct, sucking at her, beckoning her inside. Cold, fresh air slides across her legs, and she yearns to taste it. The shadow's thrashing grows more labored, and it slumps against her bed, plunging into the bonfire. Its skull splits like a pustule, acid blood boiling over the side, choking the room with sulfurous smoke. The sprinkler system doubles its output, washing the deadly blood and blue-burning alcohol outward toward the ventilation duct. Blue pushes back as far into the vent as she can go, kicking at the deactivated fan blade. The cyan flames creep closer and closer to her face, and she makes herself as small as she can be. Before the roving wave can reach her, it recedes. The flames in the shaft flicker out. She peers down the duct, through the opening, to see her flaming bed sink into the floor, the creature atop it, like a devil returning to hell. Its acid blood has created an impromptu sinkhole. Blue hopes the station's hull will eventually stop it, but it's pointless to worry about now. She cannot escape this vent. Her room is scorching hot, and she needs to wait for the acid to neutralize on the metal. So she waits in her long coffin, trapped within the walls of the cold forge, clutching her portable terminal, and weeping. Interlude. Lucy. Of all the people in RB-232, Lucy Biltmore doesn't deserve to be there. She's the one who developed a conscience. She'd written to her mom about the horrific experiments that were going on, and her communications leaked somehow. Maybe her mom's network got hacked. Maybe her mom talked to someone. Either way, it had been all too easy for her contact to blackmail her. Do as we say, or this goes out. Lucy hadn't responded. She'd been too frightened. Weyland Yutani assigned a ComSec officer to her, as well as a member of USCM Counterintelligence Command. She was given explicit instructions to report suspicious contact. Before she could answer, however, a second message arrived. A picture of her mother entering her apartment. Do as we say. Do not contact Bill Prater or Colonel Weber. Do not discuss this with your crewmates or anyone else. Whoever it was, they knew her handlers, and that was the most credible threat of all. Then they sent her code to insert into Silver Smile, followed by code for Javier's flash tool. It was supposed to export all the security feeds from the Cold Forge to a satellite downlink. That was it. There was no way the Snatchers ever could have gotten out. The cell doors were all manual control, no computer in the loop. Yet the creatures now roam the station, and it has something to do with Lucy's betrayal. She's certain of it. Watching her crewmates working diligently, taking shifts, aiming for their long-shot rescue, their deserving salvation, her heart sinks more with every passing moment. Every time she looks at her fingers, she imagines all the blood on her hands and wants to vomit. Kumbili's blood mingles with the rest of the dead. He'd comforted her without question when she was falling apart, loved her, and now he was just a corpse. "We know of your faults," someone says, and Lucy jumps. No tears come to her eyes. She's cried them sore already. It's Nick. Is it happening? Have they found her out? She looks the kid over and swallows.
"Excuse me?"
He cocks his head, concerned, verging on cautious. They've all been suspicious of her for weeks, she can tell.
"We know of 4 faults in the electricals. Do you think you can run some diagnostics?"
She stammers. "I'm not really a power grid person."
"And I'm not a project manager," Nick says, smiling at her. "But you know, stuff has to get done. We need someone to review our routing code, and you're the most available person here."
Lucy can't imagine concentrating right now. In truth, she wants nothing more than to slit her fucking wrists and bleed out in a hot bathtub.
"Sure," she says.
She imagines herself getting through this, arriving back on Earth, living in happiness for a few months until she gets the subpoena. The line of inquiry starts out innocently enough. "Can you explain the events that transpired on the Cold Forge, Miss Biltmore?" The deeper they dig, the worse it gets, until they know beyond the shadow of a doubt that it was her. She killed everyone. That's probably why Blue hates her. Lucy sees the accusations in Blue's eyes, one traitor to another. Lucy sits down at one of the Rose Eagle terminals and sighs. The letters on the screen don't want to make sense anymore, and she can't make her fingers type her credentials. It's pointless to try. Given what she's done, does she owe it to everyone to get them home safely? Can she still have a purpose when she's committed so heinous an act? They don't deserve to be here. Not one of them. Then there's Dorian, the newcomer, who had nothing to do with the hideous experiments taking place on the Cold Forge. He's the most innocent of them all, brought here by work just days before the containment failure. The man tracked down Blue's embezzlement and was probably close to sniffing out Lucy's secrets when everything went to shit. "When we get back to Earth," he'd said, "I'm going to make sure the company knows how valuable you are." And now, Dorian is out there risking his life for her, with Anne hunting down supplies. Lucy should be out there too. Lucy takes a moment to compose herself, then dredges up her login ID and password. She's sluggish and disorganized, and wonders if she'll be able to code at all. She messes up her password the first 2 times, frustration building in her gut. She strikes the enter key with a loud clack. The front door to Rose Eagle slides open. Into the hallway, where the creatures roam free. Everyone stops working. The room goes silent. They look from the door to Lucy. She gapes like a fish, trying to understand the connection between what she just did and why the door could have opened. Stephen, the tech standing closest to the entrance, stares at her with nothing short of wonder, until black talons wrap around him, snatching him into the hall. He disappears with a shriek. His anguished cries echo through the skiff, disappearing in a muffled gurgle. The others are slow to react, as though they somehow missed what happened. Then Nick, the newly appointed manager, screams to the rest of them. Run! Lucy stumbles upright from her station, her movements sluggish, as though she's trapped in amber. Another hissing snatcher leaps onto the doorframe, then at a shrieking woman who collapses backward out of the way. Lucy doesn't bother to watch. She can't care in that moment. All she can do is run. She runs to the door furthest from the snatcher and hurtles through, deeper into Project Rose Eagle, as screams grow louder behind her. Maybe she can hide somewhere. She charges for the open door leading into the entanglement lab. It has the most nooks and crannies, cable runs and crawl spaces. Surely there's a place for her there. The door slams in her face, and she hits it running full tilt, bouncing off to the ground. Blood runs from her nose into her mouth, filling her tongue with copper. The lock chime sounds. No more access for her. Or anyone. She shakes her head, dazed, lips stinging from a split. Arms wrap around her. No, she cries, throwing elbows, but the hands are soft. It's Nick. He's helping her, but she shouldn't be helped. She needs to die. Come on. He wrenches her to her feet, taking her wrist. Two crewmates rush past Lucy and disappear around the corner, headed for one of the open side rooms. So much hissing. So many screams ring out behind Lucy and Nick, and he jerks her arm as he heads for the next lab door. It's too late. The other survivors close the hatch. Nick pounds on the door, but they've locked it. Lucy turns to see if the creatures are coming for her. She wants to watch them come. To feel the biting, piercing, and ripping their dark shapes bring. Nick won't give up on her. Even though she slows him down, he takes her hand once more and sprints for the other exit to Rose Eagle. It's closed. Locked. She can see the red LED indicating that he's leading her down a blind alley, yet as they approach the door, the panel turns green, and it opens. Beyond, she sees the lime-green walls of the kennels. Lights flash and extinguish behind them. There is nothing but screaming and bedlam, and as Nick drags her away, Lucy stares back into the darkness, just as Lot's wife once looked upon Sodom. But righteous fury never comes to smite her, and they slink away together into the darkness. 26. Daedalus, who built the labyrinth. Juno's cage has become a holy temple. Dorian opens and closes doors, sounds alarms, silences others, and runs people through the hallways like rodents through a maze. With each passing moment, he adds another layer to his map of the skiff. First the creatures, then the crew, then the doors and access controls, then warnings and alarms. He guides the snatchers with a loving hand. On his terminal, he sees red dots and blue dots. He can quickly switch to the video feeds to watch the beasts skitter through the hallways. There are six people to kill, and one to save. The victim is Grenade, S, a blue dot near the front door of Rose Eagle. Dorian selects the door and opens it, and a red dot races toward the bait. Dorian watches camera feed, then sees the beast seize and drag poor Stephen away. The other blue dots remain still, and Dorian rolls his eyes. It's no fun if they just die. They need to play the game, need to try to outsmart him, or at least stretch this out as much as they can. In the end, he'll feed all the fucking rats to his predators. All except Lucy. Her dot blinks near the back of the room, which is convenient. He can't have his creatures tearing into her. Not yet. She's the weak one. the one ready to crack at a moment's notice. While he's fixated on Lucy, another snatcher bounds into the commons, knocking down Brisky, K. His quick eyes find the best angle to watch on the video, as little K stumbles backward and tries to hide under a table. The creature is quick to slide underneath with her, slicing at her with its tail and claws. Dorian isn't quite sure what he's seeing, but he's fairly certain it rips off one of her arms, before dragging her away in a wide swath of her own blood. Near to her, Sandberg, T, goes down without a fight, as though he was hoping to die. Then Lucy is running for one of the labs, and that's good. He needs her far away from the others. He slams a door in her face, and she falls prone in the hallway, the other survivors running around her, all except for Harmon, N, who comes to her side. Lucy doesn't move, though. The bitch wants to stay and die. "Get up," Dorian whispers, but she won't. It isn't until Nicholas Harmon drags her upright that they start running again. Dorian shuts the front door to Rose Eagle, giving them a few seconds to get down the hallway. By then, the other two survivors have barricaded themselves into one of the labs, much to Dorian's chagrin. He'd wanted them to spread out. This is the most power he's ever wielded, and he'll be damned if he squanders it all in a single fucking burst. Nick and Lucy are inseparable, which is obnoxious, but he'll have to let it go. Without Nick, she's guaranteed to be eaten prematurely. They head for the secondary exit of Rose Eagle into the kennels, and that's where Dorian wants them at least. He begins slowly, inexorably funneling the pair toward the secure operating theater at the front of the complex. Then he notices another set of doors. Emergency bulkheads designed to seal off parts of the station during a sudden loss of pressure. They're designed to be automated, and should boast restricted access, but the new Juno has no restrictions. She's like a newborn, completely trusting. Dorian drops segments of impenetrable bulkhead down across Lucy and Nick's path, protecting them from snatchers, keeping them moving. At long last, he sequesters the two in the operating theater and helps Nick lock the door. All that remains is to deal with the remaining two survivors trapped inside Rose Eagle, Hogan, C, and Dawn, M. Leaning in closer to the monitor, Dorian struggles to decipher their faces from the blurry feed, and tries to remember their first names. When he'd first come on board the Cold Forge, had they emerged to greet him, or had they stayed in their rooms? He touches the knife wound on his face. The other Dorian had come here a lifetime ago, excited by the prospect of corporate politics and balanced budgets. He'd come here to be a cutting agent, acting in the name of order. He'd come to trim fat. As he opens up bulkheads and hatches, Dorian knows his true purpose. Chaos is the only order, and nothing will be right until this entire station is put in its place. He picks at the loose skin on his cheek, stinging and cracking. By the end of this cycle, it'll be covered in pus and scabs. His red blood feels wrong somehow between his fingertips. He was once a white-blooded drone, but now he's a yellow-blooded killer. When he'd had a mother, she told him, "You can be anything you want when you grow up." It's time to grow up. Dorian opens the final gate between the pair of random losers and the snatcher population, setting them up for a running of the bulls. He expects it to be a short affair. After all, the things can leap 10 yards at a gallop. Yet humans are wily. Maybe these two can keep him entertained for a while. He sets off the alarms in their laboratory and triggers the Halon fire extinguishers. The blue dots begin to sprint. A gap forms between them, One of the runners is obviously faster than the other, so Dorian slams down a bulkhead between the two. Trailing behind, Don would be so disappointed to know that Hogan didn't miss a single step in running away from his trapped companion. She flees back into a different room, the acceleration lab with its many nooks and crannies. It'll take the devils a while to find her in there, and so Dorian casually routs a trio of red dots, using their curiosity for flashing lights and their disdain for sprinklers. Once the creatures enter the lab, Dorian shuts the door behind them. Abruptly, there's a frantic banging on the outside of Juno's cage. Dorian cocks his head slowly, making certain he heard correctly. He moves away from the terminal console and peers around the edge of a server rack. Through the clear stripe in the frosted glass, he sees Hogan, C. The man's face is the picture of panic, and Dorian is impressed with how quickly he made the journey from Rose Eagle. Or maybe it wasn't quickly at all. Time flows so strangely when Dorian plays God. But here is Hogan, C., who climbed Mount Olympus. He shouldn't be here. The very act of begging for entry is a mortal insurrection. Dorian regards the lock on the door. Human-proof, but not guaranteed to keep out the snatchers. He can't have Hogan, C. bringing the creatures up to meet their master. Not yet. He opens the lock, and the man rushes inside, all apologies and trembling. He hugs Dorian tightly and begs him to shut the door. Dorian strokes Hogan, C.'s curly brown hair, shushing him. "What happened to Dawn?" Dorian whispers into his ear. Hogan, C. backs away, horrified. "I didn't," he says. "Something got... somehow the pressurization system..." "Separated the two of you?" Dorian asks, flexing his fingers. His hands itch. He wants to feel what the creatures feel. "Started acting up on its own." Hogan, C.'s eyes dart across the server control room. The dumb mammal has started to put two and two together. Dorian takes a step forward, spreading his arms wide. "Was it like something was guiding you? Shoving you out of your cowardly little holes?" "Stay back," Hogan, C. says. His rearward steps take him out onto the catwalk. There, Dorian looms over him, his unusual height coming into play as he loses his humble slouch like a raptor stretching its wings. He smears away a stringy black tangle of hair from his forehead. "What was your plan?" he demands. "To run? Did you come to my temple to beg? Where's your offering?" Hogan, C.'s back strikes the railing. "You're crazy. People keep telling me that." Dorian knocks on his forehead with his knuckles. "Except I'm still alive." He rushes Hogan, C., pummeling him across the chest and abdomen, slashing at the man's eyes with his manicured nails, wishing for all the world that he possessed the talons of the devils below. He grabs his prey's love handles, pulling his gut like fresh bread dough. Though Dorian is unable to do any real damage, he can inflict pain. Unhappy with the result, Dorian switches to his teeth, biting Hogan, C.'s chest and neck, nose and brow. Sinking his teeth in as hard as he can, he is rewarded with the taste of warm, wet copper. And shrieking. Dorian grabs a fistful of the man's hair and yanks his head to one side, pressing his teeth into his Adam's apple and biting down with every last newton of force. The neck gives off a soft crunch, and Hogan, C., stops screaming. With a gurgle, he slowly goes limp. Dorian pulls, his teeth sunk deeply into the man's throat, but he can't cut through the skin. He redoubles his bite force in anger, shaking his head, trying to tear loose a chunk, but gets nothing. Finally, he lets go, and Hogan, C, slides to the ground. A distant beast cries out as it enters the Skiff Commons in search of prey. He leans Hogan, C onto one side, then pushes him out between the rails of the catwalk. The body appears to go weightless for a full second, then falls and bounces off the lower deck with a thunderous bang. Two black shapes rush forward to tear it limb from limb, neither bothering to look up. By the time he can return to the console, Dawn, M is long gone. Dragged away toward the depths of egg storage, her worthless frame the foundation of greater things. The beasts are born of human weakness. This will be Dorian's birthplace as well. Once he escapes, no one will ever know what happened here. No one but him. He sets off in search of Lucy. 27. Invigoration. Blue hasn't dared to leave the ventilation duct. According to her computer link, it's been an hour. She's moved neither forward toward her ruined room, nor backward toward the variable airflow valve. She's remained perfectly still, her heart breaking with the knowledge that no rescue will come for her. Marcus isn't coming. Her sample lies dead inside Juno's cage, his synthetic brain split open like a melon. Her chest rumbles with each breath, as if the sprinklers had begun to flood her lungs. All the smoke and ash constricts her sensitive throat. As a child, she'd once had a pet parrot. One day, her mother had burned something in the oven. Her mother sprayed cleaning solvents on the hot pan, and the parrot dropped dead from the fumes. Blue finally understands that bird, choked as she is by solvent and ash. She opens her laptop again and checks the connection. Wireless still registers in here, and she doesn't feel quite so exposed. She connects to Titus and signs in. Query? Escape pod status. One escape pod present. Condition unknown. Blue sighs. The chance of getting out of this place still exists, no matter how slim the hope. She can't give up. The loading cursor flickers on her screen. Someone is trying to talk to her. Blue struggles through a hard swallow as she waits for info. New connect. ID Marcus 014385. Init chat protocol. Signal compensate and boost 1534 plus QRAT. Fine motor. Critical damage. Isis. Critical damage. Osiris. Warning. Set. Warning. Ra. Sunrise. Marcus online. She can't believe it when she sees it. She watched Dorian beat Marcus's head in with a fire extinguisher. Marcus. Blue. Blue. Marcus. How are you alive? Marcus. My model possesses numerous regenerative functions. Blue. Can you walk? Marcus. I will never walk again. Blue. Are you okay? Marcus. I will never be okay again. She closes her eyes. Fuck. She begins to type once more. Blue. At least I understand how you feel. Marcus. You could never perceive how I feel. You are a murderer. Well, screw you too, buddy, she whispers. Blue. Where is Dorian? Marcus. Unknown. I have only just come online. Blue. Is he still in Juno's cage? Marcus. No. I am alone. Blue bites her thumbnail. If Dorian isn't overseeing things from Juno, where the hell did he go? Does he already have the escape pod codes?
Marcus. Blue. I have just interfaced with Juno. The only remaining survivors are Lucy Biltmore, Nick Harmon, and you. Director Sudler is en route to the impregnation lab. We have to stop him. Blue. Yes, we fucking do.